3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respects to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast. Today is Tuesday, the 8th of September, and thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio with me today, we've got Elena and Juliet. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sorry, let's try that again, Juliet. Good morning. Welcome, everyone. What's been going on? Any news, any updates? Any spring activities that we've been engaging in?
Well, it's always nice coming in and seeing the hot air balloons. I feel like that is always really cool.
Yes.
And it doesn't happen super often. At least I don't see them super often. I guess I'm only up this early one day a week. But it's always nice to come through on my ride in and see all these big hot air balloons.
I feel like it's always a marker of like a nice day.
Yeah.
When you see
that's
them.
That's true. Yeah. Mm. They used to have them in Canberra when I lived there, and they had some like, there's like a dinosaur one, and then there was the sky whale, which is like,
oh, I love the sky whale.
Yeah. But yeah, I remember there was a year where I was like really trying to see them, and like every morning we would get up and there would be some problem. And
oh.
So I never saw them in the end.
Yeah.
Think.
Have either of you been in a hot air balloon before?
I'm dying to do it though. I love heights.
Well, I think I went in one maybe close to 10 years ago now, and no, more than 10 years ago now. And they tend to, yeah, if the weather conditions aren't perfect, they will cancel at the last minute. So you just have to be ready to either get in one early in the morning or, yeah, just for your morning to be cancelled. So, yeah, I can imagine your disappointment, Juliet.
Yeah.
Getting up early each morning to try and catch them.
Yeah. But, no, the sky whale is really cool, though, because it's like, I don't know if you know what it looks like. It's like this massive, like, I guess it's kind of like an ovular kind of shape.
Oh.
And it's a whale, but it's like skin colored.
For listeners at home, I've just Googled a photo to show Elena.
Is not at all what I thought it was going to look
pretty creepy
like. Wow. Why?
If you Google a lot of Patricia Piccinini's work, like, it will all make sense within the context of.
That's
of
delightful.
Yeah.
When it gets even a little droopy, it completely changes shape, and that is awesome.
So I've just read a very quick description on the National Gallery of Australia website. It says, in the form of two monumental hot air balloons, the sky whale family represent nature, family, evolution, care, and wonder.
Aww.
So that's lovely.
That's really cute.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, I hope the sky whale, wherever you are, you know, blessing the skies, or maybe in retirement somewhere, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that he like travels around. Oh, like he visits different cities.
What? Yeah. When does the sky whale come here?
I don't know.
And how can I get in on that?
Let's put it out there. Let's hope the sky whale can bless us soon.
I would love that.
Okay, we've got a massive, massive show coming up today. First up, at 7:15, we'll be joined by Fiona York, who is Executive Officer at Housing for the Aged Action Group, and she'll be on the show to talk about a suite of new renters' rights services for older Victorians. So we'll be speaking to her first this morning. At 7:30, we'll be joined by Lizzie O'Shea, who is founder of Digital Rights Watch. Lizzie recently attended a hearing as part of the public inquiry into AUKUS in Canberra, speaking about the impact of Pillar 2 and the way in which Australian data could be used in the development of military technology. So that's coming up at 7:30.
And then at 7:45, we're going to hear from Heidi Everett, who's founder and CEO of Skitsy Inc., which is a not-for-profit arts organization dedicated to create a space for the expression of creativity by people with complex mental health. And yeah, Heidi's going to share the type of programs they run. And we also talk about framing sort of mental health and the need to apply the social model of disability to mental health.
At 8 o'clock, Julia will be in the studio and she'll be speaking to Sarah Wilson, a climate campaigner from the Environment Centre Northern Territory. They'll be speaking about the destructive fracking that is currently going on in the Beetaloo Basin in the Northern Territory, making way for highly expensive fracked gas and AI data centres.
And at 8:15, we'll be speaking to Maggie Munn, who is the First Nations Justice Director at Human Rights Law Center. We'll be discussing the recent report called Dignity Behind Bars, which highlights the disproportional abuses towards women, trans and gender diverse people incarcerated in Victorian prisons.
So a massive show. Make sure you stay tuned. We'll be back with the news headlines in just a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty, whoo.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, the 8th of September, 2026. Lead West, an advocacy group between the Brimbank, Hobsons Bay, Maribyrnong, Melton and Wyndham municipalities, states that the outreach services for the homeless are struggling to keep up with growing demand. Lead West Chair and Maribyrnong City Councillor Susan Yangyi says that local councils are having to take the lead in managing homelessness in the West. She states that councils are increasingly becoming frontline responders, helping people experiencing homelessness in the parks, libraries, community centers, public spaces, despite not being funded or formally recognized for this role. Melbourne's western suburbs have now reached the highest demand for homelessness services across Australia, which has prompted Lead West to call on state government to extend more support for affected communities. Peter McGrath, the Salvation Army's homelessness state manager in Victoria, shares a similar sentiment. With the demand in our entry point services, we are finding that we are having to turn away more people because we don't have the resources to assist, says McGrath. As the upcoming state elections approach, these growing issues of homelessness need to be of importance for those seeking a spot in Parliament. Funding of services of housing affordability and supply is increasingly pressing during this time. In other news, new data reveals the frequent PFAS contamination of the Murray River in Victoria. The information obtained by Friends of the Earth in a Freedom of Information request uncovers the fact that the river is not immune to PFAS pollution. The water in the Murray River barely reaches drinking water guidelines, but can still have impacts going up the food chain. The highest level of PFOS was detected at Lake Mullawalla and Yarrawonga back in 2023, which were over 36 times the ecological guidelines. Lake Mullawalla provides drinking water supply for Victoria. Previously, PFOS has also been detected at Richardson's Lagoon in Yucha in 2019 and other areas nearby Yucha since then. Waterfowl, including Pacific Black and Grey Teal Ducks, have also had PFAS detected in their breast meat, raising the question of how the ducks were exposed to PFAS. Along the Murray, over 250 kilometers between Mildura and Kunduk are likely to experience PFAS levels above ecological guidelines, which could impact hundreds of species. Meanwhile, testing in New South Wales has been limited, and in South Australia, testing has missed the detection of PFAS.
Also in the news, palliative care advocate Lida Moniava has been detained in Moscow last week and could face up to 10 years in prison. Moniava has been charged with spreading knowingly false information about the Russian army. She's a vocal critic against Russia's war in Ukraine, through her posts on social media. For nearly 20 years, Moniava has run several hospices for children, a resource centre, and a perinatal palliative care program. Through running the organisation Home with a Lighthouse, she has provided compassionate care and support to thousands of children with terminal illnesses and disabilities. Earlier this year, Moniava was fined in an administrative case for social media posts criticizing Russian attacks on civilians, including children. And despite many calling for her to leave Russia, Moniava has stayed to continue her work. Finally, in the headlines, Indra Raj Bhattarai, a human rights advocate, conservation educator, and researcher from Nepal, has stated that the devastating natural disaster of the glacial floods and landslides in Nepal and Tibet should act as a catalyst for climate action on a global scale. Bhattarai has reported to Green Left that it is not just an issue on behalf of Nepal, as Nepal adds very little to the global greenhouse gas emissions, considering 46% of the country is forest. The flooding disaster caused by the melted glacier does not only affect Nepal, but also a line of countries, including China, India, Myanmar, Bangladesh, Bhutan, and Pakistan. Bhattarai suggests that it affects all of these countries' agriculture, ecosystem, and economy. The water from melting glaciers will raise the sea level, affecting even more countries, reducing biodiversity, and introducing new diseases. There has been a call for climate talks to continue the polluter pays principle, suggesting the countries who contribute the most fossil fuels in the atmosphere should be responsible for repairing damages caused by climate emergencies. There is a Green Climate Fund funded by the UN, which was approved for $36.1 million for Nepal in order to reduce the risk of these lake outburst floods and contribute to the creation of an early warning system for the country, alerting people of impending natural disasters, preventing those thousands of lives lost. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 8th of September, 2026, and you're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
From September 15th to the 22nd, The Return, a play by Alaa Al-Qaisi, will tour theatres in Brunswick, Ballarat, Keysborough and Castlemaine. The Return is the story of Marwan Abu Samra, who awaits the return of his martyred daughters, Nagam and Rozan. Through poetry, music, and magical realism, the play explores grief, love, and what it takes to remain human in the face of unimaginable loss. For more information and tickets, go to the Free Palestine Melbourne website or look for The Return on Humanitix. Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Every day, people in prisons across Australia are subjected to strip searching. It is an unnecessary, degrading, and deeply harmful practice that must end. It involves a person literally being stripped of their dignity, forced to remove their clothing for their bodies to be inspected by prison guards, being forced to submit to humiliating requests like bending, squatting, and spreading their legs. In many prisons, people are subjected to this repeatedly and routinely. Children as young as 10 years old are being forced to remove their clothes and have their bodies inspected by adults. We're calling on the federal government to stop state-sanctioned violence by ending the routine, unregulated use of strip searching in prisons across Australia. Go to endstripsearching.com. Together, we can demand a system that upholds dignity, safety, and human rights. Fig Jam is a 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to 3CR. Heidi Everett is founder and CEO of Skitsy Inc., a not-for-profit arts organisation dedicated to create a space for the expression of complex mental health. Heidi joins us to talk about how Skitsy originally came to be, the programs that they run, and the importance of creating spaces for people with diverse mental health in the arts. We also discuss framings of mental health and the need to apply the social model of disability to mental health and what stigma means for people with complex mental health. Here is that conversation. Thank you so much for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast, Heidi. To start off with, can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about what motivated you originally to start Skitsy Inc.?
Hey, my name's Heidi Everett. There are a few Heidi Everetts in town. I don't do pottery and I don't do Reiki. I do everything else. So if you're Googling me, make sure you put mental health, disability and the arts in there. So yeah, about 20 years ago, I started this little arts organisation based on World Schizophrenia Day, and at the time, and I think still is, possibly the only public event for World Schizophrenia Day that isn't medical model based. So it was a live music show for quite a few years, and then we just kept growing it and growing it, and now Skitsy Inc. is like this year-round party of the arts. We've got an art studio, we've got a massive 6-month arts festival, performing arts festival for World Schizophrenia Day. We got a community out in Bendigo. It's just beautiful what we've got now. So
yeah, it sounds like it's just going from strength to strength, Heidi. And you mentioned that there's quite a lot of different programs across different aspects of the arts. Could you tell us a bit more about what those programs look like?
Oh, wow. Okay, so get ready, everyone. So our most favourite event at the moment is Neurovision. So I was watching Eurovision a couple of years ago and I thought, man, it's got so bright and so blingy, I can't even see the artist. Wouldn't it be great if there was a neurodivergent, sensory-friendly version of Eurovision where you could still see the artist? So I had a chat with somebody at Skitsy Inc. one day and I said, oh, can we Morph Mojo Festival of Arts, which currently is a platform of performing arts for the event, and just morph it into this sensory friendly Eurovision. And it's happened. And now, like 2027, we're going to have the second iteration of Neurovision. So put it in your calendars now. We're going to have a call out, starting in December for neurodivergent artists to do cabaret. So it's modern cabaret, song and dance, bit of theatre, bit of comedy, all around complex mental health. And then we've got an art studio, Sidus, which is a visual arts and writers collective, which is the Skitsy Inc. dedicated art space. That's just reopening down in Laneway Learning in Melbourne, in Flinders Lane. We've got a Skitsy Inc. arts community out in Bendigo, which I've already mentioned. Oh my gosh, it just keeps going and going.
Yeah, it really does. And I really am excited to hear about that. I feel like Neurovision, I love the name. And also I think it's great that it has the dual purpose of getting more people involved in getting to perform, but also for neurodivergent people to watch it as well. It's a much more pleasant experience too. So it's got that dual purpose, which
is
great.
I think I might be incorrect on saying this, but I think it's the concept of radical access, that disability is embedded in the entire work, not just the access to go and be on stage or sit in the audience, but the disability culture and identity and community is right across the whole spectrum of a piece. So we make sure that complex mental health disability is right through the whole of everything we do. So it's inclusive disabled access into audience and on stage and in production. And we sort of introduce concepts and practices around complex trauma into our work as well. And so it affects every single person that's involved in that production. And we're really proud of that.
Yeah, and I think that's what comes when an organisation is led by people who have a disability themselves. They'll actually know, representation goes a lot deeper than just like who's the face of something. Could you speak a little bit more about, the work that Skitsy Inc. does to improve representation and create that space for people to participate in the arts when they do have complex mental health?
Yeah, so this term complex mental health, it's a term that doesn't have a deficit at the end. So a lot of people say mental illness or complex mental health issues or mental health problems or mental health challenges. You know, I put it out there, why do we always have to clarify or qualify it with a deficit or a burden or a social burden at the end? So with this term complex mental health, it embraces who you are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all your life. So it's complex. So it involves trauma, decades of trauma. It involves psychiatric systems, the justice system, homelessness, substance coping mechanisms, community, culture, the arts, it just keeps growing and growing. It doesn't have to just stop at an identity that, that gives you this problem in society. So when we talk about events and workshops that we do, what do we do that's access for people to contribute to that space? It's like, right, if we're going to create a work, is there anything in that work that's going to remind somebody in your audience or in your crew of possibly one of the worst days of their life? So if it does, you might want to say it, but can you tweak it so it's a little bit more holding of that space and you're responsible for how you present that? It's things like that. It's practice. Mm. It's attitudes about being a little bit more optimistic about disability rather than, oh, woe is me and everything about me. Actually, there's identity here that's actually quite optimistic and strong.
Yeah, definitely. And I was reading, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Skitsy Inc. operates on the idea of the social model of disability. Could you, tell our listeners a little bit about what that means?
I'm sure your listeners are right across it. We're on 3CR.
That's
so
true.
Just a little recap. So the United Nations Convention of the Rights of Disabled People in about, I think it was 1980 or something like that, they said, you know what, a health condition is one thing and that's the medical model. So right up to about 1980, we were like, how can we cure you or fix you or prevent that disability? So, how do we stop blindness, or how do we create, hearing practices in deaf people, or how do we give that person therapy so they can walk better? In 1980, this big, massive group of people said, actually, we've got a health condition, we've got a health impairment, but when we go out the door, if we can go out the door, society hates us and it's got stairs everywhere and there's no Braille and nobody knows Auslan. So then it was like this massive global movement to bring society into the journey rather than just fixing the person. However, in mental health, we didn't get the memo. We're still talking about mental illness.
Mm.
How do we fix, prevent, cure, remedy mental illness. Like, come on, person, fix yourself so you're more happy. Take these drugs and do this therapy and come on, be better. Stop being a problem in society.
Yeah.
So when I talk about the social model of disability for mental health, I take away the deficit by taking away the issues and challenges and problems, and I displace it because it's not erasing the medical reality that you've got a mental illness, but it's saying, actually, what can society do now to embrace you with that survivalism that you've earned yourself of mental illness?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's particularly true for schizophrenia and depression and, you know, all those big complex mental health psychiatric diagnoses. They're survival, you know. You came up with some great ideas to get through that stuff.
Yeah.
That's just amazing. It's genius.
It really is. And I think you're touching on a bit here, Heidi, about, you know, the idea of the stigma that comes with a mental health diagnosis, and particularly for complex mental health. Would you be able to speak a bit about, your own experience of that and what it means as well to, have that lived experienced leadership when it comes to, advocating for people?
So this word stigma, it's been around for decades in mental health, and it basically means, well, there's three tiers of stigma. So one is, it's self-stigma where you feel shame about having a mental illness. It's social stigma where, the society have prejudices and discrimination against you if you've got a mental illness. So it prevents you from having access to good housing sometimes. It prevents you to getting a job maybe, or having relationships and family and dating and travel and access to the arts. So anything that sort of is implied or obvious discrimination or prejudice against mental illness, that's stigma. So I kind of, when I started out in mental health advocacy, I was right across all these big words. Since then, I'm kind of like, well, I'm in the arts and I'm in disability, and buzzwords become yesterday quite quickly. So, you know, to get a new grant, you've got to come up with a new iteration of your fantastic Neurovision project. You know, you've got to keep reinventing to stay current. But stigma, it's still stuck in this, like, I just feel like a little bit sad about the word. I feel like, it belongs in a bit of a museum maybe. And so I think, what's a word that can displace stigma? So like the medical model and the social model, you don't get rid of the previous iteration. You build on it and create something new with newer wisdoms. So if there's any young people out there or, people with enough caffeine in the system, see if you can have a play with this stigma concept and the medical model, and see if you can come up with a new way of embracing what's going on here when we think about mental illness. Because I know that so many people now identify with lived experience of mental health, complex mental health. So many of us, like, it's a workplace thing now, and the government's just going to bring out this psychosocial workplace disability platform. So it's getting more and more popular. So I think we need to come up with some new terms that have been around for a long time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, hopefully, there is someone out there with a lot of creativity who can.
I was at a symposium last week, the MacKillop Institute symposium, and it was all about youth. And oh my gosh, some of the stuff that they were saying, they were absolute living memes. Like, just, I was like, oh my gosh, did you just come up with that on the spot, or did you think about that at 3 o'clock this morning? But it was thought, we need more of that in mental health.
And if people do want to find out more about Skitzy's work and get involved and maybe attend some of your workshops, where can our listeners go to?
The internet. Skitzy is schizophrenia, shortened to Skitzy with a Y on the end, because it's Australia. We can't be bothered saying the whole word is schizophrenia. So
yep.
schizy.org, as in organisation.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck us an email.
Yeah, awesome. Well, we'll definitely have to get people to look it up and find out more. And, was there anything you wanted to finish on to leave our listeners with as they go on with their day?
Yeah, yeah, thanks. Well, thanks for having me for a start. And also just think about mental injury as opposed to mental illness. Have a think of that.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good note to end on and something for us to all think about. Thank you so much, Heidi.
Thank you.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast, and we just listened to an interview with Heidi Everett from SCITSI, which is an arts organisation dedicated to creating space for people with complex mental health. And to find out more, you can go to SCITSI.org.
We are now joined on the line by Lizzie O'Shea, who is a lawyer, author and founder of Digital Rights Watch. Lizzie also sits on the board of Blueprint for Free Speech, which was involved in gambling reform for many years, and at the National Justice Project, during which she worked with lawyers, journalists and activists to establish a Copwatch program. She joins us again on the show to discuss the public inquiry into AUKUS, recent hearings held in Canberra and the questions raised by Digital Rights Watch regarding the impact of so-called Pillar 2 on the way in which Australian data could be used in the development of military technology. Welcome back to 3CR Breakfast, Lizzie.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us on the program. To start, could you please tell us more about Pillar 2? I think a lot of our listeners would be aware of Pillar 1 of the AUKUS agreement, which is all about the nuclear-powered submarines. But what can you tell us about Pillar 2 advanced capabilities?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm really glad that you're talking about it. You had me on, so thanks for the opportunity. Pillar 2 has gotten very little scrutiny since AUKUS was really announced, and that's kind of understandable. The nuclear submarine's a big issue. The overarching nature of the dynamic of AUKUS is important. But Pillar 2, I think, is critically important. There's very little information out there, but essentially it's focused on developing technology in a collaborative way with the partners in the AUKUS agreement, with a focus on things like autonomous weapons, so weapons used in the air and oversea, things like drones, but autonomous weapons in particular, which have come under significant scrutiny from the UN for being inconsistent with our human rights obligations. So the idea is that we will develop technological capabilities with our partners in the AUKUS arrangements, and I think that gives rise to a whole range of really concerning issues around how data might be used, but also ways in which this technology might be used and whether it brings us into breach of our obligations as a country that has signed many human rights treaties and is committed to the international rule of law.
Yeah, and that's something that came up during the hearings in Canberra. I know that both you and Peter Lewis spoke a lot about concerns about Australia's potential breach of human rights, but also its alignment with the US. And you talked about, concerns or concerns that you have about that partnership in terms of who has the power, with the resources being built in Australia, for example. Do we get control over what's being used, how it's being used? I was wondering if you could talk more about this partnership between Australia and the US.
That's precisely the concern. So when you've developed technology, you can often have multiple different inputs, and the output could be a melange or a mix of all those things. So it can be sophisticated technological capabilities in one niche area mixed with overarching capabilities in another, coupled with data that might be sourced from Australia, might be sourced from elsewhere, and you get a resulting sophisticated technical product. Now, there might be, well, we know there'll be arrangements for technical legal ownership of that technology, but in reality, I think what we're going to see is that power really shapes how that technology ends up being used, notwithstanding the legal ownership structures, because if the United States wants to use this technology, I expect it will, right? So we are making ourselves subservient to their military interests. And, you know, the United States has been involved in a lot of wars that are particularly concerning from a human rights perspective. They're also actively undermining the international rule of law. They're trying to dismantle the ICC, the International Criminal Court, notwithstanding they're not actually a signatory or subject to its jurisdiction. They're actively trying to destroy it, right? So they're working in ways that I think are pretty inconsistent with our history, values, democratic principles, and essentially we're going to be building sophisticated technology in a relationship or a power dynamic that doesn't give us control over how that technology might be used. And that can compromise then Australians' data that might have gone into the technical product or the technology itself. It also compromises intellectual property and how, you know, academic researchers work on these issues and then are required or cajoled into sharing this kind of sophisticated technology with a partner that is much more powerful and controlling than us.
Yes, and transparency was one of the major themes throughout the hearing. There was also questions raised. I think it was Leanne Mitchell who asked a question about Australia's digital duty of care. And you also mentioned the new suite of privacy reforms that came through, I think, last week. So I was wondering if you could talk about these frameworks in relation to our sovereignty and safety when it comes to data and use of data.
Yeah, so people may have seen there was a suite of reforms to the Privacy Act announced in an exposure draft last week, and you're right to raise the digital duty of care. The actual exposure draft for that is coming out today. So two really big reforms in the online world, in the regulation of technology. One is about personal information and how it might be used, and the other is about imposing obligations on technology companies that offer services like social media but other services and making sure they're safe. Now, the sharing of data is really important. You know, obviously how our information is used is it's a human right, privacy is a human right, and you ought to be able to have a say over whether a company does something with your information, whether you share it in conditions of voluntariness and with a full knowledge of how it might be used. And you can understand how that might be compromised if that data is used in a technology project for military purposes with the US. And on the other side, the digital duty of care, like we're yet to see exactly what it's going to look like, but a lot of consumer-facing companies are also military contractors. Companies like Google offer military services to the US Army, the IDF, all these different militaries around the world. So a lot of, you know, consumer companies that do owe obligations under the digital duty of care will also be having lucrative contracts with the United States to develop sophisticated technology. And at times that might include Australia. So you wonder when those things become inconsistent, what side they will choose or what obligations they will choose to comply with. And I think the reality of AUKUS Pillar 2 is that it makes it more difficult for Australia to regulate some of these companies in ways that we've traditionally understood are pretty important, not just for our sovereignty, but also for our safety, for the structure of online life and making sure that its rights are respected. And that, I think, is a big problem, and we shouldn't be giving that away, certainly not without the kind of transparency that that you talked about before.
Mm. And, yeah, I guess that was something else that you brought up during the hearing that I thought was really interesting. You mentioned that, you know, there were already so many ways in which military technology and those big tech companies are already interfering with civilian life here in Australia. We know that up until recently, Coles has had a partnership with Palantir. They said that the contract will not extend beyond 2027, but I guess we'll see what that really entails. During the Q&A session after the hearing, Karina Lester also brought up the issue of data centres, and that's something that's being really huge in so many communities at the moment. So I was wondering if you could just talk a bit more about, the ways in which military tech and those big companies are already interfering with our lives, and why it's more than just AUKUS itself.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you raised Palantir. So Palantir is this notorious, they call themselves an AI company, a data analytics company. They're a notorious US company founded and run by a guy called Peter Thiel, who's very close with the Trump administration. And in essence, they offer a huge amount of logistics for military applications. You know, Donald Trump referenced them on Truth Social as being absolutely integral to their war effort in Iran right after they bombed a school and killed 60 school kids, right? So very well established as a military contractor, but also delivers data analytics services to the private sector, to the private sector, so a variety of different companies, but also, to be honest, in the UK, with a civil service, with the NHS, they deliver data analytics services there. So they're trying to integrate themselves into civilian society through corporate contracts and government contracts. Now, in Australia, Coles has had a partnership with them to do data analytics work for logistics and the like, and it's been controversial. GetUp's been running a campaign. We've had a couple of events with GetUp where we talk about the nature of this company and how it works, and they had a success in that now Coles has agreed that they won't renew the contract beyond 2027, and GetUp's still doing work on what that looks like, but I think that's a really positive sign. We don't want military contractors integrating themselves into civilian and corporate life in Australia, especially companies like Palantir, who've got a notorious track record on human rights, also collaborating with, you know, entities like ICE to identify people and mark them for deportation. So just a nasty company that we don't want in public life in Australia, I think. And so I think that's a really positive campaign. In reality, I think there are lots of ways in which AI technologies, sophisticated technologies that feel quite remote or frictionless or something that exists in the cloud and not in the real world, actually find application in the real world. So Palantir and Coles is one very obvious example, but data centres, as you identify, is the other. Now, we're going to have to build up this infrastructure to be able to process large amounts of information, maybe even train models if some of these companies like Anthropic get their way and change copyright law. And that's going to involve a huge amount of civic infrastructure and data centres that do that work. And I think there's an argument that we should retain control, transparency and insight into how those data centres are being used so that we can work out whether we want to be complicit in some of these military activities or we want us to have a say and restrict how data is processed in these places. And we also want to have a world in which that it's not hugely lucrative for these very well-resourced companies to come in and barrel through community concerns and build out data centre infrastructure that doesn't really serve local purposes, right? So I think it's a really interesting way in which we can start to build friction into the ways these systems are developing as against our interests and have try and force, I guess, these companies and the government to take communities' concerns about this technology and the impact on our local communities much more seriously than they've done before now. But I think it's a really important time. We are looking at, you know, potentially investment of tens of billions of dollars, scaling up of Australia's data centre capability of up to 10 times in a very short period of time. And I think that's got a real potential to compromise a lot of different things we take for granted, whether that's community consultation and engagement on construction of this infrastructure, as well as how it might be used in really awful ways to facilitate military adventurism, scrutiny of community surveillance and things like that, and whether we really want that to happen. And data centre construction, I think, can become a real flashpoint for having these discussions in a very real, concrete way.
Thank you so much for that, Lizzie. And, yeah, between data centres and everything that you've just talked about in terms of military tech and, you know, a recent Guardian article that said that the US now has access to more than half of Australia's military bases, it seems like this relationship with the US is getting harder and harder to sort of remove ourselves from. And I really like what you said just now and during the hearing about frictionless technology and how we need to think differently about the way in which these tech companies are infiltrating in our lives. There's so much more that can be said on this issue, and I'm sure we'll have you back on the show to talk about it again. But for now, thank you so much, Lizzie, for unpacking Pillar 2 with us on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm always happy to talk to you about this stuff, and I'm really glad you follow it up. So thanks for the opportunity.
So that was Lizzie O'Shea, founder of Digital Rights Watch, speaking to us about the recent hearings in Canberra as part of the ongoing public inquiry into AUKUS. You can find Digital Rights Watch online at digitalrightswatch.org.au. And for general information about the public inquiry into AUKUS, go to AUKUSpublicInquiry.com.
And up next, we're going to be speaking to Fiona York, who is the Executive Officer at Housing for the Aged Action Group, or HAAG HUG, an organisation specialised in the housing needs of older people. And coming from grassroots beginnings over 40 years ago, HUG engages and works with older people through community activism, services and advocacy to achieve social change and housing justice. Fiona joins us this morning to unpack a suite of new renters' rights services for older Victorians, including the Older Persons Housing Rights Service. Welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Fiona.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, it's great to chat. To start off, Fiona, can you tell us a bit about the work that you do at the Housing for the Aged Action Group?
Yeah, so our work falls into two areas. One of the areas that we work in is advocacy, so trying to make systemic change, I guess, and improve the system for older people, and we do that through talking to politicians, commissioning research, and we have lots of different groups of older people that have special interests. So we have a group of older renters, we have a group of older people that live in retirement housing, we have the LGBTIQA+ elders group, and we have a multicultural and multi-faith group, and we have one in New South Wales and one in Queensland, and a national alliance for youth housing. So all of those groups inform our work and help us know what to say when we're speaking to politicians and what to put into reports. And then the other side of the work that we do is the service delivery side. So that is working with people who are at risk of homelessness, helping them mainly get out of private rental and into public and community housing. But we also assist them connect with aged care, find retirement housing, and help them with problems in their rentals as well. So a whole bunch of different services.
Yeah, it's really important work, and I think, having both that advocacy and also service delivery is really key. And I know that a lot of listeners are aware of the many challenges of renting in this country, but could you, share a bit more about, what are the issues faced especially by older tenants?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because I think a lot of people assume that older people own their own homes, and what we're seeing through our research that we've done with Swinburne University is that there's a really big increase in the number of older renters. So in Victoria, we had one of the biggest jumps of the number of older renters in the last 10 years. It jumped into 76% increase over 10 years. So what that means in reality for older people who don't own their own homes means that they're on a fixed income usually, and they're unlikely to get back into the workforce, although some of them are still working in their 70s and even 80s to be able to pay the rent. So they're really struggling to pay the rent. They get unaffordable rent increases. They really struggle with some of them have been in the same home for 20, 30 years, and then they've got to all of a sudden navigate realestate.com, use apps, upload documents to real estate agents, all of that really difficult. And then, of course, if they're living in really run-down houses, which particularly older women are, they're living in poor condition homes, then things like steps over the bath or stairs up to the back door, if you have a fall and you're covering from a knee operation or something, it's really difficult to stay in the home. So people might not be able to get discharged from hospital into the home because it's unsafe. And then, of course, you've got people that are experiencing homelessness, so staying with daughters and sons or grandkids, sleeping on the laundry floor of their daughter's home or on the grandkids' floor, staying in cars, all sorts of things. And so it's really difficult for older people in the private rental market. And a lot of them are scared to ask for repairs because they don't want to be evicted. If they get a rent increase, they're not sure how to challenge that. Or if they get a notice to vacate and it's not valid, which is often the case, then it's really difficult. So that's what we do. We sort of step in and try and help them assert their rights and also try to help them get out of that situation into something more permanent.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, all of these things you're talking about, Fiona, it really can be especially difficult for older people when they're facing, kind of ever-changing rental conditions and kind of processes as well to acquire a rental. And I know we talked earlier in the year to someone who was talking about kind of the extreme temperatures that people can be facing in rental properties that aren't being maintained and how difficult that is. I know recently we've seen the Victorian government announced a package of services dedicated to supporting the rights of older renters. Can you tell us a bit more about the Older Persons Housing Rights Service and how it will support renters?
Yeah, we're really excited about this. The Victorian government has just funded a new service, which is building on the work that we already do, but it's a big kind of boost, which is older renters housing rights service, which will be a statewide service for anybody over 55 in any type of rental to be able to get advocacy, like individual advocacy and legal advice. So that means that we'll be able to continue to do our work in supporting older renters, but we'll also be partnering with Tenants Victoria, which is a legal service, and they'll be you know, providing us with some lawyers, which will then be able to help us do that sort of deeper legal work, because we're not a legal service, so we can't employ lawyers. So we're partnering with them, and that means that particularly retirement housing, which is an unknown area for a lot of lawyers and for a lot of people, and it's quite complicated legally. And we've had some real wins in the retirement housing space. So residents of residential parks and retirement villages will be able to have a dedicated service, as will older renters in any type of rental. So it's a big boost, and we're really happy because it actually recognises that older people do need a quick service response, that with lots of services increasingly going online to manage demand, put older people often miss out. And our service, we know how to work with older people. We're kind of run and informed by older people, so we know how, you know, how to work in a way that's appropriate, and so we can take the time that's needed. We know about, you know, having to assist with the documentation and take the time to hear the story about what's going on and then be able to assist them. So, yeah, we're pretty stoked with this.
Yeah, no, it's really great news. And I know we've also heard that the Victorian government announced that the rental task force will become permanent. Could you talk about how that's a win for renters, but especially older tenants?
Yeah, this is another thing that we think is good, because the rental task force is a relatively new thing. And in the past, Victoria has pretty okay rental laws, like because of the advocacy of lots and lots of tenant organisations for many years. Victoria has some of the best rental laws in Australia, but they're no good unless they're enforced. And so what we've found, you know, frustratingly, is that something will happen and we know that it's not right, and we have to take that and kind of prosecute it person by person and VCAT and go through these big processes, and it's pretty long-winded and painful. So having the government boost up this task force, this rental task force, means that they can actually issue fines and investigate when people are breaching the law. And that happened really successfully with a case that we ran, that we assisted with, where we reported what we thought was a systemic issue, where a provider of rental villages, which is a type of housing for older people, were not meeting minimum standards. They didn't have kitchens. It was really widespread. This was a provider that had lots and lots of different properties all across Victoria. And it was for low-income older people, so lots of people with not much money living in these places that had no kitchens and weren't able to cook food, and it was pretty appalling. And the rental task force did a very long investigation and ended up fining the provider, and that also included compensating the residents and making sure that they put kitchens in all of the units. So it was a really great win. Before they had the rental task force, we could never have had that win. So we're really happy that they're doing that, and it's also going to be good for people living in private rentals, because it means that things like minimum standards in rental properties, which are pretty, you know, they're getting there definitely in Victoria, that means they'll be enforced. So if you're seeing a place that is being advertised and it still has a gas heater, or it doesn't have some of the standards that are required, you can actually report that and they will investigate. And they also show up and do spot checks of home opens too. So all of this, I think, is good, because it shows that dodgy landlords are being watched, and that sends a message that if you're going to be providing a rental property in Victoria, you need to be meeting standards, you need to be not breaking the law, and it's on you to be providing a safe home. So all of that is good, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, the idea of that rental task force to actually be holding landlords to account is so important, and will definitely help so many people who, are facing situations where landlords are trying to, find those loopholes to not provide heating and all sorts of essential things in the home. But yeah, finally, Fiona, we know that a lot of older women, they can be more likely to face homelessness. Could you tell us a bit more about this concerning trend?
Yeah, it would be interesting to see what the next census says, but over the last 15 years or so, we've seen an increase in the proportion of older women who are experiencing homelessness, and we expect that to continue. And our view is that, and the data shows this as well, that it's a result of many, many decades of inaction and decades of gender inequality for older women. So a lot of the women that come to us were working in the 60s, 70s and 80s, often in low-paid jobs, so there was a gender pay gap. There was no superannuation. Women couldn't get loans without a man countersigning. There was no child support. So all of those things mean that now, as older women, as well as things like leaving the workforce to look after kids or look after elderly parents, it means that they don't have much savings behind them. They may have been in home ownership and fallen out of home ownership through divorce and then ended up without the property or with not enough to buy it back in. And so that's how come they're showing up now in the statistics. So it's pretty frustrating to see over and over again in any sort of data point we see, like I was mentioning earlier, older women are disproportionately more likely to be living in poor quality expensive housing. Whether they own it or rent it, it's the same. Older women have it worse.
Yeah.
And so now they're showing up in the stats, but they don't often show up. They are starting to show up in homeless services as well, but oftentimes they are hidden, and they do a lot of very resourceful work to keep a roof over their head.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of shame involved. So it is an issue for sure and something we're watching closely.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much, Fiona, for joining us today and sharing your insights on what's happening with renting for older people and the challenges that people are facing, but also some of the wins that have come through recently. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we've been speaking to Fiona York, who is Executive Officer at Housing for the Aged Action Group. And to find out more information, you can go to oldertenants.org.au. HUG also presents a fortnightly show on 3CR called Raise the Roof on Wednesdays from 5:30 to 6 p.m. For more details about the show, including previous episodes, you can go to 3cr.org.au/HAAG.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
DigiTube, People, Place, Language, connecting stories, culture and language across Australia. Contribute your content in digitube.com.au. Sign up for a free account and select your options for streaming, download and broadcast promotion.
A 3CR supporter.
Today on the show, we're speaking with Sarah Wilson, a climate campaigner from the Environment Centre Northern Territory, who is raising awareness about the fracking of the Beetaloo Basin in the Northern Territory, which has begun on the 1st of September. Thanks for coming on the show to explain this environmentally dangerous issue to us, Sarah.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. Could you tell us today, for those who don't really know, what actually is fracking?
Yeah, it's a great question because I think, I guess fracking's been banned in Victoria since 2017. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of known, obviously because of its risks, it's been banned. And it's known, I guess, colloquially to be a dangerous process. But like, actually, what is fracking? Basically, what happens is frackers will drill between 2 to 4 kilometres deep into the earth, cutting through an aquifer, and then they can drill up to 10 kilometres horizontally. And then what they do is they inject a bunch of toxic chemicals and water into the earth to basically stimulate this layer of rock called shale rock, which is where methane is stored. And then the methane will come to the surface and they'll ship that methane off. But the big risk with fracking is, of course, the fact that you're drilling through this aquifer. And so aquifers are basically like underground river systems, which form our underground water source. And here in the Territory, we rely 90% on underground water. So if we're pumping chemicals deep into the earth, there is a real risk of those chemicals leaching into those aquifers, which is so important. And once those are poisoned, you can't undo that. And then also a portion of the frack fluid that you put into the earth comes to the surface and they're held in like open air wastewater tanks. And there's a real risk of those spilling, and there has been spills before, which can then, of course, risk surface water. So that's kind of fracking in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. So it's very like environmentally risky, it sounds. And particularly for, yeah, this part of the Northern Territory where it can, yeah, affect the water supply. So, yeah, that's very concerning to hear. Which I guess follows through to my next question. So, yeah, what is the status of fracking in the Northern Territory at the moment? Why has there been this choice to frack this the Northern Territory? Yeah.
So fracking's been like a real risk in the Territory for almost 2 decades now, and the community has been so strong in holding that off for so long. But more recently, there's been the biggest ever play at fracking the Northern Territory. And the big plan is to drill up to 6,000 wells through our ancient aquifers to extract gas. So more recently, like a huge player, Santos, has entered the scene and they've actually got approval to drill 12 wells. Santos, in a recent donor briefing, stated that the Beetaloo Basin is going to be their tier one most important project, and they really want to frack the Beetaloo. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, you might have seen in the news that like first gas has flowed from the Beetaloo. So that's from some wells operated by a Texan company called Tamboran. And basically, a small amount of gas has started flowing. But it's really just the very beginning of gas expansion in the Territory, and they plan to drill, as I mentioned, 6,000 wells here in the NT. So it's just the very beginning of the campaign. All this to say that there is so much time to stop fracking, and they're really just starting. But there's broadly like heaps of gas expansion in the NT. We're kind of ground zero for it. So there's also the Middle Arm Gas Hub, which is planned to be built almost in a residential area. And the Middle Arm Gas Hub would be like an import-export terminal for gas and also for importing carbon dioxide for carbon dumping. And then there is also this massive plan for this pipeline, which would be used to pump fracked gas from the Beetaloo Basin all the way across Australia to just north of Brisbane. So it'd be this pipeline that's 1,580 kilometres long. And all of this infrastructure is needed for fracked gas to be transported. So that's kind of the current status. It's basically early days of gas expansion. It's time to stop it. But super concerning projects on the horizon.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like there's a lot that's going on. It's such a shame that it seems like this, a lot of companies are really trying to commodify this land. which I would imagine would be extremely environmentally damaging. It doesn't sound like there's been much consideration on behalf of the environment. Could you tell us what could potentially happen to the environment if this fracking and these gas expansion projects continue?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like there's a long history of gas companies putting profit before people, and this is obviously another example of that. But I guess like one thing I would love to highlight is the fact that territory nature is so beautiful and so breathtaking. People move here for camping, the outdoors, the tropical lifestyle, and we have some of the last remaining intact tropical coastlines. We've got huge free-flowing river systems, hot springs, National Kakadu Park, and it's all this to say that we have a lot to lose. So the environmental risks, as I mentioned earlier, are, of course, risks to water and underground water sources, as well as top water sources like rivers and creeks in the case of spills. Obviously, there is a huge carbon bomb waiting in the Beetaloo Basin. So the risk to the climate is a huge 1.2 billion tonnes of climate emissions, which would increase Australia's total emissions by around 20%, which is an astronomical amount. And the NT has a lot to lose. In the most recent climate risk assessment that the federal government released last year in September, they stated that the territory and the top end could be unlivable by, or near unlivable by, as soon as 2050 due to heat. So on average, we currently experience around 15 days over 35 degrees Celsius a year. But in the high emission scenario, Darwin could average 308 days above 35 degrees by around 2090. So it's a really scary outlook for the climate impacts of opening up new fossil fuel projects, which we know are fueling climate change. So, yeah, there's a real risk to water, a real risk to climate, and then, of course, processing these gas and petrochemicals at the Middle Arm Gas Hub poses risk of industrial cancer for locals. So there's, like, heaps of health fears and risks and climate risks and water risks if this fracking does go ahead at full scale, which could see up to 6,000 wells drilled through the territory.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, this is really concerning to hear. I am curious as to whether there's been any communication with any of the Indigenous communities from the area or any of the locals in regards to these fracking propositions and projects. Like, have they been... Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so important that First Nation voices are amplified in discussions about the future of fracking and the gas industry more generally, especially when we consider that the gas industry wants to drill so many wells across the territory and unleash so many carbon and climate emissions. But it's not for me to talk about First Nations communities and how they've found companies' engagement with them, as I'm not privy to these conversations. But that would be a great conversation for the future of this show.
I suppose my next question would be does the project have any benefits? I suppose what is it costing taxpayers? Are there any economical benefits for this project?
So economically speaking, fracking doesn't stack up. So there was a report done by a consulting firm called Athol Allen, and they found that if these projects were operating at full efficiency in the Beetaloo Basin, all steam ahead, fracking would still only bring in less than 1% of the territory's current budget. So since 2018, which is when a moratorium on fracking was lifted, territory governments have spent around $485 million in taxpayer subsidies on the gas industry. And ECNT, or Environment Centre NT, found a further $2 billion in subsidies and liabilities hidden in the 25 to 26 budget. So once all of these subsidies and liabilities are combined, it's unlikely that taxpayers or the government would ever recover what it actually spends on the gas industry. On top of this, federal Labor
hasn't ruled out subsidies for things like fracking pipelines. So that pipeline I mentioned earlier, which would span from the Territory to north of Brisbane, it would cost around $2 million per kilometre of pipeline laid, and that was a 1,580-kilometre pipeline. And federal government hasn't ruled out subsidies for it. So that would be around $4 billion just to build this pipeline, which is wild. And then on top of this, Territory drivers pay 32 times more in vehicle rego than the gas industry pays in royalties. And it's a really low employer. So it employs, gas industry employs like 0.7% of the Territory. Our larger employers are things like healthcare, which employs 20 times more people, and education, which employs 15 times more people. Yeah. So economically, fracking doesn't stack up here in the NT.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that seems like clear. It doesn't seem like there's many benefits at all. If anything, this just seems like a very damaging project, especially with its risks regarding water supply. So yes, thank you for letting us know about that. And I guess just for my last question, what can we do to tackle this issue? Is there anything we can do?
Such a good question. So I guess in the Territory, what we're currently doing is, as I mentioned, we've got like quite a vibrant community who fight social injustice and gas expansion up here, and it's super alive and active. And the most recent push by the community was to get hundreds of banned fracking signs on fences across the Territory. And this is all to show decision makers, politicians and gas executives that the Territory doesn't want to risk its water, climate and air with fracking wells so that these gas companies can make profit. And we basically want politicians to go into the next election knowing that if they don't have a stance on fracking, that they could lose their seat or that they won't get re-elected. So, yeah, we're basically rolling out, like, a visible fracking campaign to show huge opposition to these harmful projects. I guess this is an open call out to any of your listeners. If anyone wants to help us print and distribute banned fracking signs in Melbourne, please reach out to us. You can find our contact details at our website, Environment Centre NT. Or please sign our pipeline petition to ask the federal government not to subsidise fracking pipelines. You can donate to us on our website so we can keep doing this work. Or you can follow us on socials, Environment Centre NP on Instagram and Facebook. I think showing support that those ways is hugely helpful and beneficial. But our most current action is that we're getting signs on fences.
Awesome. Because like I guess what we've discussed, like not everyone understands the impact of fracking, what fracking is. So it's really important to raise this awareness, especially with what could happen with the Beetaloo Basin. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me on.
No worries.
Love your work.
Thanks, you too. We've been speaking to Sarah from the Environment Centre Northern Territory, who has been speaking out against the environmentally destructive fracking in the Northern Territory. And for more information, you can visit the Environment Centre NT website. You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast.
I sing the words, I will not say so.
Hey, this is Greta Ray, and you are listening to 3CR 855am Radical Radio on digital and streaming live on 3cr.org.au.
This morning we are speaking to Maggie Munn, the First Nations Director at the Human Rights Law Centre, regarding the call to Victorian government to implement a standalone dedicated legal service that challenges injustices done to those behind bars in Victorian prisons. A recent report from Flatout and the Human Rights Law Centre titled Dignity Behind Bars highlights the disproportional abuses towards women, trans and gender diverse people incarcerated in Victoria. Maggie joins us on the show today to discuss the importance of a dedicated legal service that protects people from inhumane treatment and violations of international law. Content warning. Some topics discussed during this interview contain information regarding abuses towards women, gender diverse, and First Nations people. If you find these topics confronting, please contact Lifeline at 111314 or 13 Yarn at 139276. Welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Maggie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on this morning. In 2022, the Cultural Review of the Adult Custodial Correction System called out the wide-ranging human rights issues within the Victorian prison system, yet still these inhumane practices continue. With prisons across Victoria, incarcerated people still face a critical gap with no dedicated legal service to challenge this mistreatment. For our listeners who may not be aware about the severity of the situation, what does this actually mean?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I guess you know, it's a really tricky system that we work alongside or in opposition to with respect to the Victorian prisons. A lot of what happens in Victorian prisons and prisons across the country, it's really difficult to know the extent and severity of it unless you're hearing directly from folks who are inside. And at the Human Rights Law Centre, we've been really lucky to work with Flat Out, who's a statewide advocacy service for women and trans and gender diverse folks who are incarcerated, coming out of prison or at risk of incarceration. And they've told us sort of directly just how bad things are in prisons. We've seen over the last couple of years particularly a really drastic increase in what's called rolling lockdown.
Yeah.
That is folks who are subject to, I guess, what we would kind of call solitary confinement. That's sort of the language of international law. In Victoria, they use a different word. They call it separation. But essentially, that means that folks are confined to their cells for 22, 23 hours a day with really, really little meaningful human contact. And we've seen sort of the justification of staff shortages, of, you know, behaviour, of all of these sorts of things be used to excuse prolonged and rolling lockdowns. We have heard about really kind of confronting examples where strip searching, restraints, spit hoods, all of these sorts of really kind of horrific prison practices are being used kind of disproportionately and really kind of indiscriminately against folks who are inside. We've seen and heard about trans folks who are being misplaced, so placed in the wrong prison and subject to a lot of things that nobody should ever have to go through while they're inside. And we've heard a lot about all of the different kinds of treatment that folks are exposed to and subject to while they're inside. And what we've come to understand is that it's particularly harrowing for First Nations folks, for women and for trans and gender diverse people who have sort of a whole range of intersecting experiences of marginalisation, of discrimination, of racist policing, all of these sorts of things. And so we really wanted to understand a little bit more about what it was that was happening behind bars,
yeah.
Why, you know, why there wasn't I guess a dedicated service that was supporting folks to challenge those things when they happened to them, and what the gaps were. So there's a lot of community legal centres, a lot of really great advocates and experts who are working to challenge these sorts of things, but there's a real gap in what's being provided, and we wanted to understand a little bit more about that, and so we kind of undertook this work.
Yeah, wow. I think it's really, really interesting, the kind of different terminology used rather than solitary confinement to kind of disguise the intensity of the situations behind bars. And I think, yeah, this call to a specific, you know, standalone dedicated legal service is something that is extremely needed. How could this dedicated legal service work alongside the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service Werriways Police and Prison Accountability Practice to ensure that access to culturally responsive legal services is always prioritized for First Nations people?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and that's sort of the second iteration that our team are looking at the moment. So the first part that kind of led to this report was really understanding exactly, as I said, sort of the gaps in service, the extent of issues that were occurring behind bars. And all of the different ways, I guess, that they could that folks could be supported to sort of challenge those things, and we're really lucky to work really closely and in collaboration with VALS, the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, who do such incredible work. And I guess what it is that we're really hoping from this report is that all of the different sort of community legal centres and other legal services that exist can use what's in this report to inform some of their own practice and the ways that they engage with clients who are behind bars to be able to better support them with a whole extent of issues. And as you said sort of at the outset, currently in Victoria there is no dedicated sort of prisoners legal service, and so you can get support for your existing criminal matter. You might be able to get support with, you know, a family law or a child protection matter if that's relevant for you. But in terms of anything happening to you while you're incarcerated, there's really very little avenue for you to report that, and that's what we kind of wanted to focus on with the next phase of this, is understanding how a legal service dedicated for folks inside would look. You know, how would referrals look? How would, the kind of, we call it community legal education, but building awareness of the different things that may happen in prison that are illegal or are unlawful or are deeply, deeply unjust, and to help build capacity for folks inside to advocate for themselves as well. And that's kind of what we're looking at in this, I guess, second chapter, what the best possible practice would look like, so that it's led by and informed by folks who have been inside, and us as kind of lawyers and advocates can, do the best work possible to bring about justice and fairness for folks who want to challenge the conditions of their incarceration.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so much more that we could really dive down into today. Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have. But thank you so much, Maggie, for coming on the show and shedding some light on this really serious situation, and a call out to the Victorian government to implement this standalone dedicated legal service, because that's something that is really needed within our justice system.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. That was Maggie Munn, the First Nations Director at Human Rights Law Centre, discussing the urgent need for a dedicated legal service that fights against human rights violations within Victorian prisons. These injustices not only violate international law, but also disproportionately affect women, trans, and gender diverse people. Read the full report titled Dignity Behind the Bars regarding this call on the Victorian government. Go to the Human Rights Law Centre website at hrlc.org.au.
We're now going to do our events wrap up for the week. So today, Tuesday the 8th of September at 6 p.m, there's an event, the Eureka Stockade Why It Matters Today, taking place at 251 Queensbury Street in Carlton South. And then on the 11th of September, which is Friday at midday, there's going to be a disability workers rally at 109 Burwood Highway in Hawthorne. But we've had a really massive show today. Starting at 7:15, we played an interview that I had with Heidi Everett yesterday, and she's the founder and CEO of Skitsy Inc., a not-for-profit arts organization dedicated to creating a space for the expression of complex mental health. Heidi joined us to talk about the programs that they run, the importance of creating spaces for people with diverse mental health in the arts, and also we discussed framings of mental health and the need to apply the social model of disability to mental health. Up next, Fung spoke to Lizzie O'Shea at 7:30, and Lizzie is a lawyer, author, and founder of Digital Rights Watch. And she joined us today to discuss the public inquiry into AUKUS, recent hearings held in Canberra, and the questions raised by Digital Rights Watch regarding the impact of Pillar 2 on the way Australian data could be used in the development of military technology. Then at 7:45, we spoke to Fiona York from Housing for the Aged Action Group, where Fiona is the executive officer. We spoke about unpacking new renters' rights services for older Australians, including the Older Persons Housing Rights Service, and why older renters face so many challenges when it comes to securing housing. Julia, do you want to tell us about our 8 o'clock?
At 8 o'clock, we were speaking with Sarah Wilson, who is a climate campaigner. At
8 a.m., we were speaking with Sarah Wilson, who is a climate campaigner from the Environment Centre Northern Territory, who is raising awareness about the fracking of the Beetaloo Basin in the Northern Territory.
And at 8:15, we spoke to Maggie Munn, who is the First Nations Director at Human Rights Law Centre, in regards to the call to the Victorian government to implement a standalone dedicated legal services that challenges injustices done to those behind bars in Victorian prisons.
We've had a massive show today, and thank you so much for listening to our show on Tuesday, the 8th of September. This has been Tuesday Breakfast, and stay tuned to listen to Accent of Women, which will be up next, and we'll be back next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.